Chapter 20. It may have been fate that made Eddie Ann Lillipop's rolls of Instamatic shots sail south from Montpelier, Vermont, and land kerplunk at my station at the photo lab. But I took over from there. Eddie Ann's picture order arrived in the spring of 1976, 4 rolls worth of a high school trip to New York City. Teenage girls grouped together and giggling on hotel beds and museum steps. Teenage boys flipping their middle fingers out the windows of a coach bus. It was impossible to tell which student was Eddie Ann herself, but I recognized her teacher in the very first picture that slid down the chute. I should have recognized him. Dante's letters and naked Polaroids, now 7 years old, sat back at the outreach house, stuck secretly, along with the ragged remnant of Ma's flying leg painting, in my big Webster's dictionary between the words embolden, to foster boldness in, and en brochette, broiled on a skewer. Tucked inside my knapsack pocket, these photos and that small square of canvas had made it up in the cab ride with me from Pennsylvania to Cape Cod. But I'd left them behind in the motel room that night when I left to meet my whale. Grandma, of all people, had returned them to me. In an unopened UPS box, the motel had shipped to the Easterly police, who, in turn, had driven over to Pierce Street in the cruiser. I still visited with the photographs and that swatch sometimes, usually when I needed to look up a word or prop open a window or feel some kind of intimacy with something. Dante's beseeching look still got to me. Those pictures were one of the few secrets I'd managed to keep from Dr. Shaw. Eddie Ann had it bad for Dante. Her camera had stalked him their whole trip. There were shots of him from the front, the back, both sides, pictures of him eating and snoozing, and one of him out in a hotel lobby wearing an undershirt and pajama bottoms, looking fed up. He'd filled out some and cut off his mutton chop sideburns. His straight brown hair was longish in back. Even when I squinted, I couldn't see a wedding ring. I began to think of Eddie Ann as a sort of kid sister in conspiracy, and of Dante as my future. All of Dr. Shaw's speeches about self-actualizing and taking charge began, suddenly, to take on new meaning. Dante looked nothing like the big, curly-headed man I'd etch-a-sketched in Nadine's kitchen, but, I reasoned, any number of things could explain the discrepancy. Maybe Dr. Shaw was right and Nadine was a quack. Or maybe predicting a future just wasn't as exact a science as I'd presumed. I made myself an extra set of Eddie Ann's prints and sent her order back to her, minus the pajama bottom shot, which, I decided, in a big sisterly way, was inappropriate for her to have taken. I worked overtime through May, June, and July, saving for my new life. None of the operators I called would give out his address, but the Providence Public Library had a whole wall of phone books from around the country. Out of those thousands and thousands of pounds of tissue paper pages, I found him. Davis Dante, 177 Bailey Street, 229-1951. In the hush of that library, my own breathing was the loudest sound. There was a copying machine on the third floor. I intended only to Xerox Dante's telephone book page as a souvenir, but in the quiet, I heard Dr. Shaw challenging me to create my own happiness. I looked around, then ripped out the original. I tell you, I was emboldened. I dropped a nickel into the copier anyway, then pushed my face to the glass and felt for the button. The heat from the flash made me feel like I'd done something permanent to myself, something I wouldn't be allowed to undo, that I'd sizzled myself in some way that was both risky and right. On the bus back to the outreach house, I took out my growing portfolio, the old stolen letters and Polaroids, Eddie Ann's shots of him, that phone book page, my Xeroxed face. Jack Spite and my father hadn't been vulnerable men, and Dr. Shaw had wielded power in a style all his own. But there Dante still sat, naked and confused, someone to love. In my Xerox self-portrait, the hair around my face, the cracks in my lips, were clear and razor-etched, lines sharper than any etch-a-sketch I'd ever made. But the rest of my face had a vaguer, more foggy look, like something religious. A smiling, closed-eyed Shroud of Turin woman, some mysterious saint Grandma might pray to. If you want your prayers answered, get up off your knees and do something about them. That was a poster in the kitchen at the outreach house. Maybe I'd peel it off the wall and sneak it with me when I left. What had derailed Dante from his Lutheran school education and made him go north to Vermont? His voice, more baritone than I'd expected, wouldn't say. "Hello? Who is this?" he kept asking.
"Be patient," I'd answer, but never out loud.
I made up lies about mountain air and back to nature to explain to my co-workers at the lab why I'd chosen Montpelier. On my last night at the halfway house, Mrs. DePolito made manicotti and meatballs and hugged me so tightly that I half wondered if I'd imagined all her meanness. There were crepe paper streamers and dancing, and at the end, Fred Burden made a speech about me and gave me my going-away present, a 12-inch black-and-white portable TV they'd all chipped in to buy me. I hugged Fred and whispered that my etch-a-sketches up in the attic were his. In mid-August, Fred and his sister Jolene drove me to the Providence bus station. The bus was late, the humidity a killer, and Fred looked pale as a mushroom. "Is it scary?" he asked me.
"Is what scary?"
"Doing this. Moving where you'll be all alone." For the first time, it occurred to me that with or without a wedding band, Dante might be married or engaged. Until Fred's question, I'd imagined Dante in a sort of a Lutheran sleep, lulled into inertia by his subconscious instinct to wait for me. "Not at all," I sniffed. When the bus driver announced we were ready, I squeezed Fred's hand and kissed him on that rocky road of a cheek. It wasn't nearly as awful as I'd imagined, my lips against those ruts and eruptions. When the bus pulled out into the traffic, I waved to Fred, who was crying, and wondered if I hadn't made a crucial mistake, obvious to everyone but me. I had rented my basement apartment by letter, 177 Bailey Street, apartment 1B. The landlady, Mrs. Wing, had described the house's Victorian features but failed to mention anything about its being located at the top of a hill so steep that you practically needed mountain climber boots. My suitcase and shoulder bag took on weight with every step. The palm of my other hand ached from the handle of my portable TV. I thought about that first day at Merton College, climbing the steps to Hooton Hall, about getting out of the cab and climbing that sand dune at Cape Cod. I set the suitcase down on the sidewalk and sat on it, looking back down at the town. It was dusk. Lights were going on all over the place. "You're a whole different person now, reparented and everything," I reminded myself. "Dante's waiting for you, not that dead whale." The key and a note were scotch-taped to the door. "Welcome, Miss Price. Please join us upstairs for cocktails at 4 o'clock tomorrow. Sincerely, M. Wing and C. Massey." Real smart, I thought to myself. I'd given up a perfectly good life to drink sherry with old ladies. Apartment 1B was two dampish, furnished rooms, kitchen and bedroom sitting room, both illuminated by bare bulbs that stuck out of porcelain necks in the ceiling. The bathroom had a cracked toilet, and a shower head closed up in a kind of narrow tin closet.
The floor of that shower stall looked cruddy enough to grow a disease. The closets were roomy. The phone was already connected. An oval window above the kitchen sink looked out to the tenants' parking spaces like a 2-foot eyeball. I unpacked and had my supper. A cigarette and a travel-dented Milky Way I'd bought out of a machine at White River Junction. I set up the TV on the bureau across from the studio bed, hooking a coat hanger antenna off the back the way Fred had shown me. Charlie's Angels was on, Farrah Fawcett snooping around some crook's hotel room, wearing just a camisole. 10:30, I said out loud. I'd been in Vermont almost 3 hours, without any physical proof that I was living in the same place as Dante. On TV, there was a close-up of a turning doorknob. Farrah sprinted toward the closet, her breasts bobbing. In the kitchen, I pinned a towel up over the eyeball window and boiled water for a cup of instant coffee. Some occupant before me had stuck keep-on-truckin' decals on the cabinets and left in the refrigerator a half-empty jar of Maxwell House, 3 Pabst Blue Ribbons, and an unopened jar of Spanish olives. The oven was thick with grease. In the cupboard was a single ceramic cup with a Hawaiian hula girl built into the side, Mount Rushmore style. They'd dug out her chest area and put a wire across and a pair of free-swinging ceramic breasts. "Shake 'em, don't break 'em," the cup said. "Honolulu Lulu's novelty shop." I went back to the bedroom and flopped down on the scratchy daybed. Back home at the photo lab, third shift would be just getting started, doing their address labels, checking their chemical levels. I picked up the phone to call, to just say hi, then hung up. You didn't telephone people if your new life was working out. You're a dumb asshole for drinking coffee at 11 p.m., I thought to myself. Now you'll be up all night long. I thought I heard my doorknob click. Imagine Dante opening it without even knocking, smiling, entering my apartment on the power of his intuition. Did I like that or didn't I? I faded off to sleep, trying to decide. By the next morning, I was up early, watching tenants' feet pass by my round window. Nurse shoes and orthopedic scuffies. Teachers travel in summer, I reminded myself. He was probably visiting family or off somewhere on a religious retreat, praying for a girlfriend who'd love him unconditionally. I walked out into the crisp, sunny day and down the hill to Mount Pelier. Red geraniums bloomed in storefront window boxes. Clerks whistled and swept the sidewalks. He'll show up, I told myself. This place is happily ever after. The Grand Union was nearly empty. A row of checkout girls stood at their stations, chatting to one another in their matching red smocks and Farrah Fawcett hairstyles. I bought a bag of low-calorie groceries, a TV guide, and a can of Easy-Off for that mucky stove. At the drugstore, I treated myself to a Mount Peculiar T-shirt and some rubber shower flip-flops. The purchases relaxed me, made me feel like a part of the town, some ordinary shopper. Just before trudging back up the hill, I spotted a second-story beauty parlor on State Street. Chez Jolie, House of L. There were 2 banners in the plate-glass window. Walk-ins welcome, and, hey, look, the Farrah look. In the stylish chair, I faced myself. Drab, pouchy-faced Dolores with long hair the color of dirt. I chose ash blonde from the color wheel. My stylist smelled like coconut. Over the snip of her scissors, the whir of her blow-dryer, she talked a monologue. She was voting for Ford, not Carter, she said, because at least Ford was used to the job. She'd gotten 6 crockpots for bridal shower presents and had to give up jogging after her daughter was born because she just kept peeing her pants. "If Jimmy Carter wants to be president so bad," she said, He should have had those whitish lips of his surgically reduced, or pigment tended at the very least. When I left 3 hours later, I didn't look like Farrah Fawcett, but I didn't look like myself either. I figured it was a draw. On impulse, I turned into a lady's shop and bought a $25 salmon-colored camisole without once making eye contact with a sales lady. I went back to the drugstore for some pink lipstick and a blow-dryer of my own. At the top of the hill, my panting made me dizzy. Figuring Mrs. Wing and C. Massey were widow companions, I dressed in my white Oxford blouse and calico skirt. But when I knocked on the door of their main-floor apartment that afternoon, I was surprised to find a bony old man on the other side. He was wearing a blue kimono, pajamas, and those scuffy slippers I'd spied. "Ah, you must be the new renter," he said. "Come in, come in." His eyes bounced off my Farrah hairdo and landed on the front of my blouse. "I'm Chadley Massey," he told my chest. Inside, chubby little Mrs. Wing sat surrounded by embroidered pillows and Chinese antiques. Her kimono was in blood and egg yolk colors, and her hair was a black pageboy wig. "How wonderful to meet you in person," she said, smiling. She had white powdered skin and yellow teeth. Mrs. Wing assigned me a love seat across from her. It had carved wooden dragons for arms. Roving Eye squeezed in next to me. I figured talking might quiet my shaky lip. "Nice decorations," I said. "I'm getting a craving for egg rolls just sitting here." Mrs. Wing didn't seem to get the joke. She asked me if I was returning to the area or if Montpelier was new to me. "New," I said. Mrs. Wing nodded. Without looking over, I could tell old Roving Eye was checking me out. "So are you two brother and sister or something?" I said. The two of them shared a laugh. "Mr. Massey and I are close personal friends," Mrs. Wing said. "Live in," he added. "Oh," I said. "Different strokes for different folks, right?" "Different strokes for different folks," Mrs. Wing repeated, clapping her hands. "That's delightful. We'll have to write that down in our book, Honeydew." Honeydew touched me on the wrist. "Marguerite and I keep a notebook of the interesting colloquialisms we hear," he explained. "I didn't make it up or anything. It's from a song. Sly and the Family Stone." Mrs. Wing got up off her sofa. "Now, if I don't write it down, I'll forget it." Chadley slipped his hand into the space between our legs. "You sure must love China," I called to Mrs. Wing across the room. "Oh, yes. Our passion for Orientalia was what brought Chadley and I together initially. Now, what was it? A different stroke for a different sort of folk?" "Marguerite and I are compatible in every way," Chadley said. His knuckles skidded against my thigh. "As a, for instance, we enjoy sexual intercourse nightly." My smile twitched. "Imagine that," I said. Mrs. Wing sat back down and Chadley's hand went back to his lap. "How old would you say we were?" he said. "Take a guess." They both had skin like wrinkled-up paper bags, but I figured it was in my best interest to aim low. 63? 64?" "Ha! Not even close. I'm 77 and she's 81. "Really?" I said. "You don't look it. What's your secret?" "I believe I've already mentioned it," he said, winking. Then an oven buzzer went off in another room, and he shuffled out to get us our drinks and snacks. "So what brings you to Vermont, dear?" Mrs. Wing wanted to know. "Your letters were written with such a sense of urgency." I fed her my line about fresh air and nature. Oh, well, you'll have to meet one of our other tenants, then.
Really? Who?
Mrs. Lagatuta. Lovely woman. She's a nurse, very active in the Audubon Society.
Oh, I said, birds.
And then, of course, there's Mr. Davis, right across the hall from you. He's a lovely young man, a school teacher here in town. Has quite a green thumb, too. He's planted a lovely garden out back with...
A teacher, you said.
How about his wife or girlfriend? What does she do for a living?
Why, il n'est pas attaché, she said, smiling.
What?
He's unattached.
Does his share of tomcatting, though,
Chadley called in from the kitchen.
I hope you like stuffed mushrooms, young lady.
They're Chadley's specialty, Mrs. Wing said. He sautés canned crab meat, then he crushes Ritz crackers with a rolling pin and...
Hi-ho, crackers, Marguerite! Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work!
Shut up out there, you little dwarf, I felt like yelling.
So this teacher guy likes gardening, I said.
Oh, yes. He's kept us in vegetables and herbs all summer long. Has the time to spend on it, you know, with his summers free. Has time to entertain a chippy or two every once in a while as well, Chadley said.
Overnight, that is. The ice cubes clinked in our gin and tonics as he hobbled toward us. I'd meant to move nonchalantly to a chair for one while he was in the kitchen, but the information about Dante had distracted me. He sat back down beside me.
Yes, well, Mrs. Wing smiled.
That's fine with us.
Chadley and I feel you young people have the right idea with your sexual revolution. Why, I was married to Mr. Wing for 43 years, God rest his soul, and never once achieved an orgasm. Had never even considered clitoral stimulation until I was in my early 70s, had I, Chadley, dear?
But we've made up for lost time, right, Honeydew?
Chadley said.
Yes, Honeydew.
Mrs. Wing beamed.
This man is a precious gift.
It occurred to me that Chadley and my grandmother were exactly the same age. If Grandma had ever heard about clitoral stimulation, I was pretty sure she had classified it as a mortal sin and dismissed it. She would die before she called someone Honeydew. You were supposed to transfer the stuffed mushrooms onto your little oriental plate with a porcelain-handled spatula. I hadn't planned on any chippies.
Chadley watched a mushroom shake on its way to my plate.
"What sort of work do you do, Dolores, dear?" Mrs. Wing asked. Getting a job was a subject I'd let myself ignore during all my planning and plotting. "Worry about that once you're settled," I kept telling myself. But now I was settled.
"Well, I've been working at a photography studio," I said.
"But really, I'm an artist."
Mrs. Wing's hands flew up in delight.
"How wonderful! What medium do you work in?"
"Etch-a-sketch."
Mrs. Wing cocked her head into a question. Chadley's mushroom stood poised in front of his mouth.
"But mostly watercolors," I added.
"Paint them.
Watercolors."
"Ah, lovely." Mrs. Wing grinned. "May we see your work sometime?"
"Well, it's pretty personal. I don't expect to make a living at it or anything. I was thinking of filling out an application down at the Grand Union to tide me over."
I hadn't been until that second. But it was picturable. Me in a red smock, bagging groceries. I chugged my drink, said no to another, and got up to go. Mrs. Wing was on her feet, too. "And now, dear, if you can sit down again for a minute, I'll get the lease for you to sign before it slips my mind. You sit, too, Honeydew. They're in the armoire, aren't they?"
"Yes, my love."
When she left the room, I reached for another mushroom, figuring if my mouth was full, I wouldn't have to talk to Chadley. His liver-spotted hand landed back on my leg, and he started stroking. "You know," he said, "I think the three of us are going to be fast friends. I have a sense for such things." The hand brushed up and over toward my crotch. I sat there, frozen. That mushroom stuck halfway down my throat.
"And we could have a private friendship as well. You and I," he whispered. "I'm very partner-oriented, you know. There are things I could teach you."
He leaned over and began to sniff at my hair.
"Visualize your solutions," I heard Dr. Shaw say. "Picture an answer to the problem, then make the picture real."
I stared at that little hors d'oeuvre spatula. I picked it up and held the corner of it against the top of his hand, pressing down a little. It was my decision who I wanted touching me. I didn't have to take this kind of shit from Jack Spite or his great-grandfather. His hand paused for a second. Then it began kneading my thigh. I put more pressure on the spatula, enough so that he flinched.
"Cut it out, you old motherfucker." I said it softly, met him eye to eye.
This time he stopped for real.
"Let's keep the party friendly, shall we?" he said, "for Marguerite's sake."
I let up on the pressure. I'd made a red indentation on his skin.
"Tight-assed bitch," he mumbled. "Old fart," I mumbled back.
"Here we are," Mrs. Wing said, re-entering. "You sign right here."
I wavered twice in the middle of my signature. My name on the lease was shaky, but legal. Back in the basement, I flopped down on the bed and cried until my ribs ached. I could so have a normal sex life, as soon as I felt ready for one.
"Sex is something shared between two consenting partners," I heard Dr. Shaw say. "What Spite did to you out there in the woods was about violence, not sex. It was about degrading you."
That old goat upstairs hadn't known me for 5 minutes before he'd started grabbing. Of all the nervy, degrading, old motherfucker, he could put that one down in their stupid notebook of colloquial expressions. "Honey, do my ass." A normal sex life. I was ready for one. That was why I'd come all this way, why fate had put Eddie Ann's pictures in front of me in the first place. I opened my dictionary and studied Dante's Polaroids. Then I went to my drawer and took out the camisole. The silk material slid coolly against my skin. Did a tight-assed bitch wear one of these? I walked unsteadily toward the mirror. My face was puffy and pink from the crying. The lingerie hugged the bulge around my middle. There I stood, fat, ugly Dolores with a new Halloween wig of a hairdo. Who did I think I was kidding? Fred Burden wasn't home at the outreach house when I called. Neither was Mrs. DePolito. A bunch of them went bowling together. An unfamiliar voice said, "Can I take a message?" I couldn't tell if she was a new case aide or a new crazy person. Someone occupying my old bed and eyeing Fred, seeing all those good qualities he had beneath that rocky complexion. I opened the refrigerator and stared at the food I'd bought in town that morning. Cottage cheese, tuna salad, Diet Pepsi, yogurt. Hopeful things. I blushed at my own idiotic hopefulness. I'd been a stupid fool to sign that lease, to give up all I had. I reached past my purchases and took out the three beers the last tenant had left, opened one and poured it into the Hulick girl cup. I sipped my way down the foam, drank, twisted open the second beer. The hula woman's eyes were closed, and she was smiling coyly. I gave her breasts a little swing. Some man was supposed to think he was giving her sexual satisfaction by playing with him. Some man, no doubt, had made the cup in the first place.
"Don't let them degrade you like that," I told her.
I drained the cup and turned it on its side, prying with a fork until the wire popped out. I slid off her ceramic breasts. Back at the photo lab, it was me who spoke up when they gave the dirty work only to the women. "Right on, Dolores," Grace and Lydia would say when I stormed toward the office. Now the hula girl had a caved-in chest. Mastectomies. Her shut-eyed smile transformed itself into something else. The smile of someone brave and knowing. Someone whose pain had made her wise. Unlike myself, who sat in a basement wearing a dumbass hairdo and getting woozy on Pabst Blue Ribbons. I got up and paced, feeling that beer slosh in my stomach. I belched so loud it scared me. I pulled off the camisole and got into my new flip-flops and my paisley muumuu, the one I'd worn since fat days. It wasn't entirely true about my not learning from pain. Upstairs, I had stopped him, hadn't just let him degrade me the way I had with Jack, or taken my anger out on a tank of innocent fish. I'd hurt him back a little, directly. Visualized a solution to my problem and then made it real. "Take a chance. Be gutsy," Ma was always saying after she got out of the crazy hospital. Moving here might have been stupid, but it was gutsy, too. I was standing in my own apartment that I'd rented all by myself. Those were healthy things in the refrigerator. I had lost 126 pounds. In the kitchen, I spotted that can of Easy Off and got down on my knees. The directions said to wait an hour, to let the foaming action do the work for you. But work was what I wanted. I wished I'd remembered to buy paper towels. I used a Brillo and the camisole instead, scouring and wiping away the grease of 1,000 fatty meals. I only stopped once to pull my hair back into a sweaty ponytail. Maybe I'd dye it back. Maybe I wouldn't. Part of me hoped Fred Burden wouldn't call back. I stepped back to admire the oven's gleam, but looked instead at what was in my hand. I'd turned that fancy underwear into a brown rag. Outside, it was cooler, and a breeze dried my sweaty face. I walked clear of the house. Out back, I found his garden. He'd terraced it against a bank at the edge of the woods. The lowest row was a neat line of marigolds, then cucumber vines and summer squash, waxy-looking cabbages, glossy eggplants. The staked tomato plants were heavy with fruit in all stages of ripeness. If Fred called back, I thought, I might not hear the phone. A rusty Volkswagen rumbled up the driveway, radio blasting. The brakes made a watery sound. He got out without turning off the engine and walked around back to have a look. Tank top and cutoffs. No shoes. He'd grown a beard since Eddie Ann's pictures. I tried to tiptoe past, tried to calm my heart. "Hey, whoa!" he said. "Hi! Hi!" His finger pointed at me. "New tenant, basement apartment, right?" I nodded. "I've been cleaning the stove. I'm Dante. Live right across the hall from you." He seemed less real than his pictures. "I'm Dolores," I said. "Dolores," he repeated. "Okay, great. Welcome." "I have to go wash up now," I said. "I've been cleaning the oven." "Right. You just told me that." "Oh, I did? Sorry, I like your garden. At least I assume it's yours, right?" I started toward the house on wobbly legs. Wearing my muumuu, for Christ's sake. "Hey, whoa! Could you do me a favor? Could you put your foot down on the gas so I can check something back here?" He patted the car's roof. Piece of shit automobile. The driver's side door was dented in. There was a hibachi on the passenger seat, a jumble of mail and newspapers on the floor. The radio was playing an oldie, one of my and Jeanette Nord's old 45s.
"Yoo-hoo," he said. "Now."
"Now? The gas?"
"Yeah."
"Okay."
I pushed my foot against the pedal.
The whole car vibrated.
"Our day will come if we just wait a while."
"Once more," he said.
I made the engine roar. My body shook with its revving, and when it subsided, with the sound of that song, its promises of everlasting love and dreams made magic.
"Okay, fuck it," he said. "Thanks."
He reached past my leg and turned off the key. The backyard went quiet.
"Mrs. Wing says you're a teacher," I said.
"Uh-huh. How about you?"
"Professional oven cleaner."
"I'm an artist. I'm not that good, though."
"How about you?"
"I'm not that good either."
I laughed.
"What do you teach?"
"High school English. You know, the scarlet letter. Who and whom, where to put the apostrophe.
Hey, listen. I'm getting this brainstorm. You want to do some supper after you get cleaned up?"
"Oh, well, actually, I have some more stuff to do."
"Okay, I got it. Take your shower. Take your time. I'll go get us some wine."
"What goes with cheese popcorn anyway, white or red?"
Nothing charming would come out of my mouth, only my stupid, nervous laugh.
"You decide," I said.
In the shower stall, my elbows kept whacking against the tin walls, calling up a rumble like thunder. He was real. We had a date. All of it was actually happening. I began humming something, quietly first, and then I was singing.
"Our day will come if we just wait a while."
It was something I'd never done before, sing in the shower. I sang and sang over the ringing telephone, Fred Burden returning my call. If I answered, I'd regain my life at the halfway house. Or worse, be demoted back to the wards at Gracewood, be fat and crazy again. I stayed under that hissing water until Fred gave up. We sat at his glass-top kitchen table drinking wine from coffee mugs. Through the clear glass, I saw that my thighs were bigger than his.
"She and her husband were New Deal Democrats," Dante said. "Henry Wing. He was pretty high up there in the Roosevelt administration."
Her non-orgasm years, I thought to myself. Come to think of it, she'd started in late on her normal sex life, too.
"She sure loves antiques," I said.
He sipped his wine and smiled.
"Yeah," he said. "And Chadley's her favorite one."
"Dirty old man," I mumbled.
"That he is," he laughed. "But harmless."
"He is now," I thought.
"By the way, I like your shirt," he said.
I had put on jeans and my new Mount Peculiar T-shirt. His looking at it made me self-conscious, and I pulled my knees up to my chest and stretched the shirt up over them. I'd bought a large out of habit.
"Get this one," he said. "I was going out with this girl last spring who used to come over here. One afternoon, right after she leaves, Chadley shows up at the door. Says he'd appreciate my letting him know if we might ever enjoy the pleasure of a third party in our lovemaking."
"No, sir," I said. "I kid you not. The pleasure of a third party, like something out of the etiquette book."
"Did Mrs. Wing know about it?"
"Oh, hell no. This was strictly confidential, he assured me. The randy old bastard."
He made it sound funny. Turned Chadley into a cartoon. Dante was nothing at all like I'd imagined he'd be. Nothing like his old letters. If it wasn't for those eyes,
I'd have almost wondered if I'd aimed my new life at the wrong Dante.
So you're an artist, huh? What kind?
There was a second where I almost told him the truth.
But I was afraid I'd start with etch-a-sketching and end up with Dr. Shaw and reparenting and stealing Kippy's letters. Instead, I wove him a lie about watercolors and disillusionment and a guy named Russ, a long-term relationship I'd just decided to move away from.
And my artwork was part of all that, I said. So I'd just rather not go into it.
A clean break, he said. I can respect that.
He took a sip of wine, watching me over the rim of his cup.
Then he leaned forward and his smile turned into a long, soft kiss.
Supper was bakery bread and his garden vegetables, raw or just barely cooked. We started with a perfect red tomato, cold from the refrigerator. He sliced it in half and salted both pieces, held out one. My thighs were jiggly from wine and kissing. The tomato tasted sexual. After we'd done the dishes, he reached up and touched me on the shoulders.
So, he said, do you want to go to bed with me? Or shall we keep it at vino and veggies?
I didn't say anything.
So, anyway, what do you think of the New Deal?
I shrugged.
So anyway, your phone is ringing.
I hear it, I said.
We could call it intercourse, keep it nice and dignified.
Involuntarily, I cracked a smile. His hand reached down for mine. He glided his fingers back and forth in the spaces between my fingers.
Shared between consenting partners, I heard Dr. Shaw say. Or we could be very hip, very 70s, and call it having sex, you know? Lots of experimentation and position switching. Chapter 6 in the manual.
You're embarrassing me, I laughed.
Hey, I've got it.
Let's just make love. Lights off, candle on the bureau. If you give me a minute, I could probably find my old Roy Orbison album. Ever do it to Blue Bayou? I shook my head and took a sip of wine. The phone stopped ringing.
Okay, I said. Okay, what?
That last choice. I'll take that one.
Aha, he said. Very nice. The lady opts for romance.
In the bedroom, he kept kissing me as he slipped out of his clothes. I was too close, the room too shadowy, for me to study his body the way I would have liked. But when he undressed me, slowly, gently, I was grateful for the semi-darkness. My nakedness was what he was feeling, not seeing. With the lights on, he might have detected evidence, the stretch marks and puckers of fat whale Dolores, the girl whose body I had and hadn't shed. If he could see me, he might stop. He guided me down onto his bed and sat next to me.
Can I ask you something first? He whispered.
I waited.
That phone that was ringing? Was that your disillusionment calling you? The guy you moved away from?
Yes, I lied. He let go of my hand and stroked my cheek with his smooth hand.
One more question. You on the pill?
Yes. I lied again. I hoped he hadn't felt me flinch.
Okay, then, he said. All systems go.
My mind floated in and out of what he was doing. I watched the way the flickering reflection from the candle swayed against the wall, heard his voice speaking the words of his old letters to Kippy. I reached behind his neck, pulled him closer, kissing and kissing him. He slid his body down the side of me, and I felt his lips against my hip bone, his fingers feathering the inside of my leg. His touch was relaxing and exciting both,
I closed my eyes and thought, I made this happen. I absolutely deserve the way he's making me feel. His hand reached down and touched my foot. I bolted up straight in bed. Stop it, I told him. Don't. He sat up.
What? He said. What's the matter?
The candlelight caught his face, flickered against his worried eyes. He was himself again, not Jack. My feet, I said. It's just... I don't like anyone touching my feet. I began to breathe hard, to panic. Then I was crying. He put his arm around me and waited. My sobbing quieted, and the room filled up with music he'd put on. Jim Morrison's doomed voice. I'm sorry, I said. I'm just being stupid, I know. He took my hand in his.
Hey, relax. I forgot something anyway.
What?
Dessert. Be right back.
He slipped out of bed and into his jeans. The outside door banged. I reached over and took a gulp of wine. I didn't want to be by myself. I wanted those feelings back, the way he'd started to make me feel. He came back with two small yellow marigolds from his garden. He took his jeans back off and got into bed. Holding both flowers out to me, he twirled them in his fingers so that they spun and blurred. Pretty, I said. Where's the dessert? He passed the blossoms lightly against my face, then down to my breasts.
This is it, he said. Marigolds. They're edible.
They are.
Marigolds?
He pulled petals from one of the flowers, put them in his mouth, and chewed. Then he plucked some for me and held them to my lips. Hesitantly, I opened my mouth. Their sweet taste surprised me. Do you still believe in God? I said.
The word still hung in the air. I'd blown it, given away my knowing Kippy, his Lutheran school dilemma, everything. But then he grinned, oblivious. Isn't "Do you believe in God" a little heavy duty for our first date? I think you're supposed to hold the line at "Do you believe in astrology?" or "Do you believe Jim Morrison is still alive?"
Oh, I said, sorry.
I don't, though. No, since you asked. Used to. When I was in high school, I thought I wanted to be a minister. Can you believe that one?
What made you change your mind?
Oh, it's a long story. Basically, I realized it was something I was doing for my mother, not me. Then, let's see, lost my virginity, got involved in the anti-war movement for a while, enrolled in a teaching program. Figured it made more sense to save people for the here and now rather than the hereafter, you know?
I reached for him, questioning. He was and wasn't the boy in the letters.
How about you? He asked. What do you believe in?
A shiver passed through me. Me? I said. I don't know.
No fair keeping secrets.
You cold or something? Want a blanket?
Whales, I said.
That's what I believe in.
Whales? You mean like ocean whales?
I nodded. He nodded back.
Yeah, he said. They're cool, aren't they? Sort of mysterious. Come to think of it, I could believe in whales.
His arm hair felt silky against my fingertips. Could you... I began. Do you think you'd like to try making love again? His mouth kissed my mouth, his tongue my tongue. I felt him go hard against my leg.
It appears I would, he whispered.
He guided me back down onto the bed and began kissing my shoulder, my breasts. Not kisses, really, but a brushing of his lips against my skin. The kiss of the marigolds against my nipples.
He entered me gently, tentatively, waiting.
"Yes?"
he asked. I nodded, and he began to rock his hips slowly, smooth, sexy figure eights from side to side. He watched me as he did it.
"Okay," he said.
"You like?" I kissed him and reached down past the curve of his buttocks, felt for the back of his legs, pressed my hands against them. He closed his eyes and smiled and drew himself deeper inside of me.
"Oh, yeah, nice," he whispered. "Very nice."
Nothing about him was desperate or angry. Tears fell from the sides of my eyes, but I was smiling, too. I deserved this, I reminded myself. I'd worked long and hard to feel what he was helping me feel. He wasn't the boy in the letters. He was. Wasn't. Was. My decision changed with each drawing back, each new thrust. I closed my eyes and saw Ruth's and Larry's white bodies against the dark on Grandma's floor. Saw them sharing each other. Saw Ruth, her shirt pulled up, her full breasts dripping with milk for Tia. I rose and rose, arching my back, pushing up to meet Dante. His sighs were soft and distant. He could believe in whales. His movement quickened, and I caught his rhythm, matched it over and over.
"Oh, God," he said, stopping abruptly.
Then he tensed and sighed, and I felt that part of him begin to spill and rush into me. Milk, I thought. Men's milk. The milk Larry had let go into Ruth to make Tia. The milk that made Ruth's breasts fill up with milk. My mind spun. My muscles tightened themselves around him. We bucked and gasped and came together.